Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today on the show, I have with us Mark Pollack, who is the president and founder at the Giving Back Fund. Mark, thank you so much for being here and excited to have this conversation with you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Prior to hitting the record button, you know, we were just chatting a little bit before it and sort of relating some commonalities that we have. Obviously, first and foremost, it's our Jewish background is something that we have in common. And so this conversation that I want to have with you, I want to focus the bulk of it on the Giving Back Fund and what you've been up to there over the past, I believe, almost over 24 years now. But I would appreciate it if you would just share with the audience a little bit about yourself and how you kind of started your career in philanthropy and giving back and what that's meant to you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me on your podcast. So this is the second career for me. Many people do several careers in their lives right now, and this is my second. I am a Holocaust scholar, and I thought that would be my life. I did three graduate degrees with Elie Wiesel, whom we both know, and that was a great honor. And then had the opportunity to do all the things you would do in academic Holocaust studies. I worked on the museum in Washington, which you know about. I founded the Holocaust Center in Miami. I taught at the University of Miami. I would lead trips to the camps in Eastern Europe. I worked in Israel at a place called Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Memorial. And after not several years, but maybe a few years of working in Holocaust studies, I looked out at my class one day at the University of Miami, and I had that epiphany moment where you know that something is just not quite right. And so I called Elie Wiesel, and I said, I have to come see you. I'm having a midlife crisis. And he said, but you're only 32. And I said, well, but it's an early crisis. And I went to see him in New York, and I said, here's my crisis. I'm teaching people not to kill other people. It's not a good idea to kill other people who are different than you. In other words, what happened during the Holocaust. And yet there's killing going on all over the world, as there is today. You can just look, turn on the news in Afghanistan. But back then it was in Cambodia and it was in all sorts of places, Rwanda. And I said, my teaching about the Holocaust to suburban kids who are attending the University of Miami is not stopping the killing in Rwanda, and it's not stopping the killing in Cambodia, and it's not going to stop the killing in Afghanistan, obviously. So here I'm very good at teaching Holocaust studies, but I'm teaching it to kids who are never going to kill anybody anyhow. So it's not reducing the hatred in the world. And that was why I went into Holocaust studies. I don't have any family members who were in the Holocaust. I just hate injustice of any kind. And so I've always opposed injustice. And the Holocaust was the biggest injustice I could ever imagine. And so I was drawn to that. And then, of course, with the opportunity to work with Elie, I was drawn very deeply in. And so he said, well, what do you want from me? I was your PhD advisor. I said, well, I have an idea. And I pulled out of my little briefcase, back then they had typewriters. I don't know if you're familiar with what that is, but they used to have typewriters. I am. And I had typed up a little 5-page proposal to create a foundation in Elie's name that would do human rights around the world. And it would be in his name because he's famous and I'm not. And I would run it. And I would, by doing that, feel like I was having more of an impact in what the reason I went into Holocaust studies in the first place was to make the world a little bit better. And just teaching at the university and teaching about Holocaust studies wasn't making the world better. And so I had no hope that he was going to say, okay, you could use my name. And I remember handing him this little 5-page description of what I had in mind. And he looked at it for a while and then looked at me for a long time. And then he said, well, do you think you can do this? And I had no clue. It was just an idea I had in the shower. But somehow I looked him in the eye and I said, absolutely. I don't know where I got that strength to say that or even, you know, I really had no idea if I could do it. But I said, absolutely. And he said, okay, if you think you can do this and you follow these 5 criteria, apologize for the puppy, then I will lend you my
name. I support that. I've got big German Shepherd down the hall. So if he sees someone out the window, we'll hear from him too.
Just a little one. And so I created this entity in his name. And then 6 months later, he won the Nobel Peace Prize, which makes you an even bigger celebrity. And literally, I learned the power of celebrity, which, you know, that you can call anybody in the world. And if you're a celebrity, they return your call. If you're me, they don't. And so I would call in Elie's name and say, I'm calling on behalf of Elie Wiesel. And people would call me back, even leaders of countries. And so it was a powerful impression that was made on me. And several years later, not that many, the idea of the Giving Back Fund popped in my head. Whereas what I was doing for Elie, I could do for anybody who had wealth and fame, and you link those two together and leverage both on behalf of a cause. In Elie's case, it was human rights around the world, but in anybody who's famous and wealthy, in Angelina Jolie's case, it's refugees, and Michael J. Fox, it's Parkinson's, and Muhammad Ali. So no matter what they cared about, if they had wealth and fame, you could leverage those on behalf of their cause. People care about what celebrities care about. And so I knew nothing about business, nothing about creating a company. All I was a Holocaust scholar, and that's what I knew. But this idea came to me to create the Giving Back Fund and to work with famous people, athletes, entertainers, and help guide their, and I did some research first, and athletes and entertainers were having a terrible time, and a lot of them still are, at running foundations. They don't usually go according to best practices. And the press loves to seize on that, of course, and write big exposés about so-and-so's foundation didn't follow the rules, and it got, turned down by, it got decertified by the IRS. There's no greater example of that than our former president. And so I thought, here's a niche, just like we were talking off camera, that you also found a niche that you filled. And I thought, celebrities don't have anybody who can really provide expert organizational skills and the knowledge of nonprofit management at a reduced cost, because we're managing many, many foundations under one umbrella. So there's an economy of scale savings. So I'm bringing 10 times the expertise that they could have on their own for a tenth of the cost. And more money goes to their charitable mission and less to administrative overhead. So I thought, there's an idea there. And I didn't have any money. I didn't know anything about business. But just like you or any entrepreneur, I had the drive to try to do this. And so somehow I found some money, and somehow I hung a shingle. And you have to have luck. And I had a little bit of luck in the beginning. So the luck was the first four clients were pretty famous. The first client, I was in Boston at the time. We're a Massachusetts public charity. The captain of the Celtics at that time was my first client. The second client was a little quarterback who threw the most famous pass in college football history, Doug Flutie.
Doug Flutie.
And then Doug happened to have a fan named John Bon Jovi.
Wow.
And Jovi, since you have guitars there, you've heard of. And John said, you know, I just built this house. It's 87,000 square feet large, and we're opening it up. I'd love to offer Doug the opportunity to have a fundraiser at our new house. Would you be interested? I said, yeah, I'll check with Doug, but I think we would be. So we had this incredible fundraiser at John Bon Jovi's mansion in Red Bank, New Jersey. And at that fundraiser was the agent of two young superstars who were in love. One was named Brittany and the other was named Justin.
Wow.
So they were our third and fourth foundation. We announced Justin's foundation at the White House with the Clintons. And we announced Brittany's at Nickelodeon in Los Angeles with about 1,000 photographers there. And so that's how we started. And then I'll pause there and you can ask other questions. But that's how I went from Holocaust studies through Elie Wiesel and creating a foundation for Elie, understanding the power of celebrity, and then move towards, well, if I can do this for Elie, I can do it for 100 people or 500 people.
It's awesome. I mean, I'm really blown away. I had heard about the Giving Back Fund and was familiar, certainly at a high level, about your work, and was really excited when the team reached out. I was doing a little bit of research on my own. Hearing you articulate the formation, your early learnings, being with Mr. Wiesel, and then obviously getting this up and going, is really inspirational. I'm curious, I want to talk about some of the impact and some of the current things that you're doing now. But a lot of what I also appreciate about this show is helping educate other nonprofit leaders about ways that they can start and improve their organization. And I love what you're doing, where you are providing economies of scale and ways for individuals to be able to give back and start the foundation. So I'm just curious if you could talk about, in your own words or in your own thoughts, advice you might give to someone that's considering starting an organization. Obviously, you're doing it with celebrities, but, and can you talk a little bit about this model? Because I imagine the way you're set up is essentially to be a fiscal sponsor of these foundations.
Yes, we offer four different kinds of sort of sponsorship. We can offer you a DAF, a fiscal sponsorship, a corporate foundation, and a public charity. So depending on what you need, and are you a person or are you a project? Like we have this organization Nexus, which is this incredible organization. I hope you'll ask me about 7,000 young people around the world. That's more a project, an entity. Whereas, you know,
wow, I didn't realize you're Nexus Global.
We're their fiscal.
Yeah, sponsor. That's so unbelievable. Cool.
It is.
You're a humble guy. I appreciate you.
So that's one type. And then Yao Ming has a foundation with us where it's just a standalone, but it's his own foundation that he puts money in. So we have the opportunity to be very flexible. And I think your question is about how we achieve lower costs, which means more money goes to charity. It's very important to me. When I saw, Forbes magazine used to do a column every year on the five worst celebrity foundations in America. And they would love to do these gotcha columns. And one year we started working with Magic Johnson because he was in the top five. 87 cents of every dollar went to overhead, 13 cents to charity. Mm-hmm. Evander Holyfield was number two, and there was a number one. If you want to know who that is, I'll tell you. But at any rate, that's not good.
I do want to know. Who was it?
It was Alec Baldwin.
Got it. And was the, you said it was the captain of the Boston Celtics. Was that Larry Bird or?
No, it was D. Brown. It was
1990. Got it.
D. Brown. He won the slam dunk by going like this and dunking with his Reebok pumps.
Awesome.
D. Brown was our first client. And so what we began to learn is that celebrities usually have, you know, their mothers, brothers, fathers, sisters, sometimes a French poodle running their foundation. And I love French poodles, but they don't have masters in nonprofit management. And so, and you know, the mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers are well-intentioned, but if you don't really know, you know, you have to understand what D&O insurance is and what an audit is, what a 990 is, what state registrations are, what good ratios are. There's a lot to know about the, you know, best practices of running a nonprofit. And so the best of intentions will make your charitable efforts go awry if you don't really know how to do it professionally. And that's what I thought the Giving Back Fund could add to this field, is lowering costs, increasing expertise, so that people who want to do good, who happen to be famous, will do good right.
I think it's phenomenal. I mean, obviously you found your sector and focusing on the celebrity market. I think the macro point though, and my message also, and I, you know, maybe you could talk about just in general, is to anyone that's interested in doing good and just starting some sort of nonprofit organization. I mean, of all the groups that we work with and all the different individuals that have started and are running nonprofits, they generally all know what the mission is in some general sense. And they often can really closely resonate with that market. I mean, for example, if someone's starting a food bank to help feed homeless people, they might've been homeless themselves growing up, so that's meaningful for them. Or, you know, someone's dog died of cancer, so they set up a nonprofit to help dogs with cancer, or whatever it may be. But that business acumen, I find to be very low, quite frankly. And what you're doing is awesome to be able to provide that. But I also just want to say in general that I know, you know, your focus, you're dealing with the celebrities, that there are, you know, resources and support. So if individuals are listening to us right now and either have a nonprofit and are trying to get to the next level with it, next step, or struggling, or thinking about starting one, there are a lot of different resources out there and fiscal sponsorship type of entities that you can work with that provide those services. I mean, obviously you're doing it specific for celebrities, but it's a really great model. And quite frankly, we need more of it because I think a lot about, I'm curious sort of your sense of this, but we have all the, you know, tons of new business formation every year. And then rightly so, actually new nonprofit and corporation has been growing faster than new business formation. And so, you know, in starting Charity Charge, we had, every business has struggles internally. I mean, you're just trying to figure out your operations and getting everything going and up and running. It was a big learning curve for me. I mean, there's a lot of things you don't know when you get started, but I think we forget that a lot of people that are starting these nonprofits don't necessarily know what they're doing, and that's okay because they know the mission. So a little bit of a rant on my side, but I really appreciate what you're doing. It's so needed.
Let me just correct one thing. We started out working with celebrities, mm-hmm. but I learned early on Einstein's theory of insanity that it's a very hard market to work with because the vast majority, about 95% of celebrities, don't put any of their own money in their own foundations in their own name. And to me, that just seems not right. If you're a celebrity who's asking the public to contribute, and presumably you have a little bit more money than the public, and you're not contributing anything to your foundation with your cause that you're so passionate about, why should the public give? Well, because generally they don't know that the celebrity isn't giving. But I do know now that I've been doing this for 25 years, that about 95% of celebrities don't put any of their own money in because they say, well, I'm famous. And if I say I'm interested in helping dogs with cancer, then my fans will put money in. And that's great. But unless you're willing to be transparent, and transparency is a core value of the Giving Back Fund, unless you say to them, listen, I just want you to know that I care more about this particular mission than anybody in the world, but I'm not putting any money in, but you should. Unless you're willing to say that, then you're kind of not being completely honest with the public. And so we went for years trying to change the culture of celebrities and philanthropy in the United States. We did a bunch of different things. We created a Giving Back 30 with Parade Magazine. And every year we would rank the top gifts by celebrities, the top 30 gifts. But after a few years, we did it for 5 years, numbers 25 through 30 started being embarrassing to the celebrities. They were big celebrities and they were giving like $25,000 a year. It's not impressive. And so we weren't able to really change that culture. So we changed and we expanded to work with the Nexuses of the world, regular people, corporations. So now we do have a lot of celebrities in the Giving Back Fund, but we also have a lot of everything. And we'll only work with a celebrity if, and we're not the philanthropy police, I won't tell you how much to give, but you have to make a meaningful gift. Like if you're a big celebrity and you put $5 in, that's not meaningful. And so that lowers how many celebrities out there we can work with. And we're working with anybody else who wants to do meaningful philanthropy.
I think it's awesome. Can you expand a little bit? I know we've talked a little bit about Nexus. Can you share some stories, mention some of those organizations? And if there's any particular anecdotes that you'd like to share, I would love to hear those.
Yeah. What's so exciting to me about working at the Giving Back Fund is we never know what's coming in the door tomorrow. So everything, we've had foundations.
It's the same here. I just have to tell you that there, and when I say this, I mean, I truly mean it. So we've been, obviously prior to us officially, been up and running for about five and a half years now at Charity Charge. And it was many years before that of me stumbling around trying to figure out how to put this together. So I really resonate with you when you say like you were in the shower and you had this idea, then you made it a vision. But there is truly a nonprofit for anything. It's unbelievable. Every day our phone rings and it's someone with some different organization. We never heard of that cause or mission or whatever. So go ahead. But I totally relate to you of saying you never know what's going to come in the door.
And so we're constantly surprised and we're constantly learning about things that we didn't even know existed that needed help all over the world. We do work everywhere in the world. And so we've started foundations for things, for diseases I've never heard of. We are the leader in Batten disease research, which is a very small disease that's like ALS for children. It's a
wow. You know, here in Austin, we have the Beyond Batten Foundation.
Well, that's the disease.
Yeah, exactly. That I might maybe offline, we can connect about that or maybe be able to put you in touch with them. But I am familiar. I mean, it's yes, the whole rare disease
We have several.
It's just very fascinating and obviously needs attention because they are rare, but keep going. I interrupted you.
I believe very strongly in trying to cure diseases. And so over the years, I believe we have not cured a disease in this country since polio. So we've been to the moon, we've gone to Mars, but in 75 years, we have not cured a disease. And so we've done three major summits, one in Parkinson's, where we have the top people in the world, Nobel Prize winners, come together and see, and we charge them with this single goal. If money were no object, we'll raise you any amount you need. Will you agree on a consensus on how to get to a cure, and will you share data? And we did that in Parkinson's, and we came up with this incredible $250 million project with our donor. And then unfortunately he passed away. So we handed the plan to Michael J. Fox. We did it in lung cancer. Michael Milken keynoted that. And then with Steve Gleason, one of my all-time heroes in New Orleans, who has ALS, the former Saints player, who won last year's Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian honor in the United States. We created an ALS summit and invited the top people in neuroscience in the whole world. And out of that grew an organization called Answer ALS, which is a $540 million project to cure ALS in 5 years. And so we're deeply involved in trying to cure some diseases. That's exciting to me. We have a big depression foundation with the head guy at Harvard Medical School, who's the most cited researcher in the entire world, Ronald Kessler. And it's called PTMD, Precision Treatment of Mental Disorders. And I mean, if we had all day, I could tell you about all the intricacies of all these foundations, but they're so important and so interesting. We have a foundation called Surgical Theater with former Israeli Air Force pilots who flew F-15s, and they learn, you don't just go up in the plane in an F-15, you learn on a simulator before you take an F-15 out. It's a pretty powerful piece of equipment. And so from that, they developed a technology that cost $1 million each that hospitals now use to be able to increase brain surgery success rates by 80%. It allows the surgeon to fly around in your brain and see every aspect and angle of where the tumor is connected, so that when they go in to operate, they've already practiced the operation 8 times, and it saved countless lives. We have that foundation. So I could go on and on and on, but my point is the missions and the causes are so diverse all over the world, and they're so interesting and exciting, and we get to help these people do good everywhere in the world.
That's awesome. Talk to me about in order to be able to do this, I'm just thinking about, you know, the team that you've had to build out. Can you talk about some of those functions and just what sort of infrastructure did you need to build over these years to be able to do this?
Well, so we started out small in Boston, and then we grew. So we are a community foundation, but very, very different than regular community foundations. Community foundations in Austin or Boston or Cleveland or wherever, they offer you a donor advised fund if you're in that community, and they'll do grant making for you. But if you called them and said, listen, I want to build a women's shelter in Haiti, will you meet me there on Tuesday? We're going to find land. The person on the phone in the Cleveland Foundation doesn't say, okay, I'll get on a plane and go to Haiti. Well, we do. We get on a plane and we go anywhere in the world that you want. I went to China to build schools with Yao Ming, and we find the land and we find a contractor and we oversee everything. So we're a community foundation that has staff that actually staffs all these foundations and goes anywhere in the world and builds things that you want to build. And that's the difference from us and a regular community foundation, although in the IRS's eyes, we're the same as a community foundation, but we're not geographically based. We're over all 50 states and we do work around the world.
That's awesome. Curious to also understand about your governance. I mean, being the founder of this organization, can you talk a little bit about, I imagine you have a board. Can you talk a little bit about their role and the importance of that? And I'm curious, obviously, specifically as it relates and any stories you want to share, but I also think, you know, I'm thinking about individuals who might be listening to this, thinking of starting an organization. And I really think it's important that people that have never started a nonprofit understand some of the fundamental differences between a for-profit and a nonprofit. One of the big things is the requirement to have a board, and then also understanding what the true role and responsibility of that board is.
Absolutely. And boards, the ideal nonprofit is when you can establish equilibrium between a really excellent board and really excellent staff. If you have either one that's not excellent, if you have an excellent board but a terrible staff, or an excellent staff and not such a good board, you won't be a successful nonprofit. You have to achieve that equilibrium of an excellent staff and an excellent board. And so the very first thing you do is look around for people who really care about what you care about in order to have a board that is educated and able to help you right now. So the one advice I would give to anyone wanting to start a nonprofit is don't be afraid to cold call. You cannot be afraid to cold call and ask for help. When I founded the Giving Back Fund, I knew no celebrities, and I cold called Bob Costas and he became my founding chairman. So you have to be willing to just
Syracuse.
What?
And he went to Syracuse, Newhouse, where my grandfather, father, and brother are all Q's grads. So big supporter there.
So that was our first chair. Right now we have a chair, Lisa Greer, who just wrote a book on philanthropy called Philanthropy Revolution. Wow. And she's our chair now. We have a 17-person board of very, very accomplished people. And then we have a 55-person advisory board that you could see on our website of a whole potpourri of successful Americans who don't have fiduciary liability for the Giving Back Fund. Our board does, but they're there to help me open doors because I can't open every door. So people like Bill Walton and Jamal Wilkes and Larry King, when he was alive, he just passed away. They are all on that board, and they help me open doors that I otherwise wouldn't be able to open, or I can call them and they give me some advice. So I have this 55-person advisory board, a 17-person board of directors, and a pretty good staff. So that's how we're beginning to grow, and hopefully we're going to double and triple in size in the next couple of years, because we've really grown a lot during the pandemic, which is strange because we're working from home.
Can you, I'm curious too, I mean, I want to talk about COVID and the pandemic and how you're thinking about growing. What I'm curious to ask is, I totally resonate with what you shared about the board. I think it's so critical. And I love how you talked about having that even balance on both sides of the staff and the board. From a operational and just compliance perspective with respect to IRS and laws and stuff, how does it work when a celebrity would partner with you? Do they need to have their own board members? Can they have their own board members for their respective organization or project? What's that look like?
Great question. And the answer is they have the best of both worlds. They can have what's called an advisory board, or they can call it a board of directors. They can call anything they want. But their board, while it has all the obligations, responsibilities of a board, has no liability. Our board, our overall board of the 17 people, oversee all of the foundations under the Giving Back Fund, even though many of them have their own advisory boards. And so you can go to someone and say, I'm with the Giving Back Fund. They give me my 501c3. I'd like you to be on my board, but guess what? You have no financial or legal liability. Well, that's an easy ask, because if you ask someone to be on a regular nonprofit board, you absolutely have financial and legal liability. That's why you have D&O insurance. So we have D&O insurance, and we have a board that oversees every single foundation. Now, they don't oversee every minute detail. They depend on the staff for that. But the answer to your question is every single entity that uses us for a 501c3 has the best of both worlds. They can have their own boards, but their boards have no legal and fiduciary responsibility.
Got it. Makes a lot of sense. And speaking of, just curious too, I was pulled up your website because you were talking about some of your board members. I'll have to scroll through it more to see if I have any direct connections, but it looks like Elliot Kotek is an advisory board member. And I just thought that name sounds so familiar. And I believe that he moderated a panel that I was on 5 or 6 years ago at South by Southwest. And I popped his name into my Gmail and it pulled up an old email thread or whatnot. So anyway, shout out to Elliot. I think that that's super cool. Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. I could ask you so many conversations about a lot of these people. I'm sure it's just so interesting getting to know so many people. And then for them that they get to join in this either as a board member or advisory capacity and, you know, be able to give back to all these groups. I'm sure it's just so fascinating and exciting for them. You've created a lot of goodwill here. Can you talk a bit about, you talked about growth, which I want to get into. And one of the, again, the trends that I've been watching that I found really interesting is the growth rate overall of the nonprofit industry, especially in terms of new entities being formed. You had mentioned a moment ago that you were looking at potentially doubling or tripling. I'm not sure over what time period, but what has, if you could roll back sort of a year, year and a half, what has the past year and a half been like for you and for these organizations run by celebrities? Like how have they responded during COVID? And then also, yeah, what does the future look like?
So we've had an explosion in growth since COVID, which surprises me tremendously because we all went to work at home on March 3rd, 2020, and we haven't been back since. And so it just feels different than being in the office every day, walking down the hall, seeing your colleagues, feels very different. But we've grown like threefold in size during the pandemic. We opened 20 different COVID foundations around the world, 4 social justice foundations projects after George Floyd, and then just all the regular philanthropy that comes to us. And so we're the philanthropy partner of the entire NFLPA. There's an 800 number that rings in our office that every player has a card that they can call. And this number rings in our office and we give them expert advice on philanthropy. So we've grown during the pandemic. People are home. People who have money are being generous to try to help with COVID. We've done a lot of work around the world in COVID, a lot of work. And then the future growth is we're about to celebrate our 25th anniversary, which is a big milestone. And the sky's the limit. We're opening an office in London, in Canada. Those countries don't really have organizations like we are. So I think we have a tremendous opportunity to do philanthropy there as well. And I think we've done no marketing at all for 25 years. And we've grown, we've had over 550 foundations in that time. So I think if we did any marketing, we would grow. Because now we, you know, people know about us. And because we work with celebrities, we get a lot of press. But I think if we actually did marketing, that would help us grow quite quickly. And so I'm anxious to start doing marketing.
And can you, I know also I was looking through your website, it appears that, you know, you'll do different events and things of that sort. Any sense of getting back to doing those types of in-person events?
Yeah, that's the biggest conundrum. For years, I've had this dream that our 25th anniversary, we do the largest event for charity at the Super Bowl every year. It's called Big Game, Big Give. It's a big deal event. It's at a private estate, the nicest estate in the Super Bowl city on Super Bowl Saturday night for 500 people, 100 celebrities and 400 people who pay $3,000 a ticket to come. And it's a very special event. And it just so happens that the Super Bowl is in LA, where I am this year. And it's our 25th anniversary this year. And everything was going to be just a perfect storm. And now COVID hit. And now the variant hit. And so we're scrambling to find, I don't think we can put 500 people in a house, no matter how big it is. Even if it's as big as Jon Bon Jovi's, we can't do that during COVID. It looks bad. And I would never want to have anybody get sick at our event. And so it's created havoc. Nexus has had to cancel its events. They do big summits at the UN, at the Institute of Peace in Washington. They can't hold live events. I don't know what we're going to do during the Super Bowl, maybe some smaller event outdoors. And all of our foundations that have events have been canceling them because you can't, you know, I'm somebody who believes in science and we're not going to put anybody at risk, not for charity. So it's a mess. And it is for most charities. Everybody's going to virtual, but it's hard to charge people to be on a Zoom. So this is a challenging moment in the charitable world.
What sort of just general advice would you give to someone that is just operating a nonprofit and maybe trying to obviously do their best, but has been struggling throughout COVID? I know it's sort of a generalized question, but you've obviously advised all these different foundations. So I guess I could ask it more directly. What sort of commonalities have there been, you know, throughout COVID with these foundations and the challenges that they were coming to? You'd held up that card where there was that 800 number, I believe. Any specific themes, anything that comes top of mind you might share?
Well, the people who are doing COVID relief are doing really well because everybody's contributing to that.
Yep.
The other foundations that are just doing all these other things are having a little bit of trouble if they depend on events to raise money. If they have some other source of income, then they're fine, but nobody's been able to do their events. And so money is really tight. So I've noticed that, you know, a lot of foundations have closed or gone into hiatus. What I would recommend to people, the general public, is there are something like 1.7 million nonprofits in the United States. 75% of them have annual gross revenues of less than $25,000, which means that the vast majority of nonprofits shouldn't even exist. In the business world, they wouldn't. But in the nonprofit world, nobody makes you close as long as you file your 990 easy. So what I would suggest is, in a time like this, see if there's anybody else out there doing something very similar to what you want to do and form a partnership with them. Bring two candles together, the flame is higher than if they're separate. So I always encourage people to collaborate, to work together, to form partnerships. And then the political problem with that is you have less overhead because instead of having two overheads, you have one, but somebody might have to lose their job. But if you're trying to cure Parkinson's or trying to cure cancer, if you have eight Parkinson's organizations, you're just cannibalizing each other. The idea is to cure Parkinson's. That's the disease. So by having one, you'll have seven executive directors who will not have a job, but all that money will go towards curing Parkinson's. So what's more important, having a job or curing the disease?
Absolutely. I want to go there for a second. I know it's a little bit of a detour, and then we'll wrap, or could seem like a detour, and we'll wrap this up. But I do want to get into that philosophical side, because I think it's important that I believe that it's important that I continue to send the type of message where you're going. And I think you do as well. I'm going to grab a book right here just to relate to it. This is a book by my friend John Brothers. He's the CEO of the T. Rowe Price Foundation in Baltimore. The book is on titled Building Nonprofit Capacity, A Guide to Managing Change Through Organizational Life Cycles. Obviously, right now, as I mentioned, he runs the T. Rowe Price Foundation, but he has had a very long career advising and building and starting nonprofits. And one of the big things that he did in his prior work to T. Rowe Price was advise and help on this concept of the mergers and acquisitions, or when is it appropriate to shut down an organization. And quite frankly, I don't think we see enough of that in the space. I mean, you mentioned the numbers. So interesting that 75% of organizations have less than $25,000 in revenue. And then even if you move it up, I'm going to be off on this number, but I would say that probably 95% of nonprofits have less than $250,000 in revenue. It might be 500. I think it's 250. So we have all these people that are so passionate or got started it for the quote, right reasons, I believe, but then are just struggling trying to get their organization to some meaningful size to scalably make an impact. So does it come down to those politics or sort of ego where people just aren't willing to set that aside? Because you talk about, you know, the reality you might merge, but then you're out of a job. So it's just a very interesting thing that just is going on in the nonprofit sector, has been for a really long time, and quite frankly, probably will continue to.
It causes tremendous inefficiencies. It really does. And yes, the reason that all these stay open is everybody wants to keep their job, even if they're just making $15,000 a year or whatever. So I don't know how we can solve it, but in the for-profit world, this would never happen.
Right, right.
Be able to stay open. And so in the nonprofit world, there's really no forces, that economic forces, that force you to close. And it creates a lot of inefficiencies. There should be so many mergers and acquisitions in the nonprofit world and consolidations so that the work of the nonprofit, the missions of the nonprofits are accelerated. Instead of getting three calls from someone who says, will you donate to my foundation to do X? If X is the same in all three, you're just bifurcating the potential donors out there and you're taking all the overhead times three instead of having two-thirds of that go towards whatever the worthy charitable mission is. So of course you're taking money away from achieving your goals, but it's human ego, because do you want to not have a job? Do I? No, we both want jobs. So who's going to give up our job? Neither one of us. So there has to be some way to consolidate, because it's very inefficient.
I would say for right now, in the one-by-one example, and for the purpose of this conversation, for those listening, would be, if you are the individual that's going to be donating funds, just do your research and do your homework and ask the right questions of the organization. So I think the selection of where you choose to give your funds is important. You know, just as it's relevant, as you were talking about those lists that would talk about celebrity nonprofits, and some of them, it was, you know, 80 or 90% of every dollar was going to overhead versus the reverse. So I do think a difference can be made, certainly on the individual level, but it's a significant, just systemic thing that's happening, you know, that is sort of the nonprofit complex, or just, it's all around us. So anyway, these are awesome points. You know, Mark, I want to also just bring up for those that are listening, if you are interested in learning more, you can go simply to givingback.org to access the website for the Giving Back Fund, givingback.org. Mark, are there other ways that people can learn more, or if someone's listening and they want to work with you or talk about setting up a foundation, what would you say to them?
Both. we are hiring right now. We're advertising three different positions, and our main position are foundation managers. Each foundation manager has a portfolio of many foundations that they oversee. We're advertising for those people right now. Anybody who wants to have a career in philanthropy, reach out to me, either at that website or mpollock@givingback.org. And anybody who wants to do philanthropy, I think we offer a turnkey approach where the costs are really low, and we have over 250 years of experience combined on our executive team. So you get the benefit of all that experience at a tiny fraction of the cost. So I'd be open to speaking with any of your listeners.
I think that's amazing. I will put out also in our newsletter separately, we're happy to post those job descriptions or link to wherever you have them, because I'm busy doing my day job with Charity Charge, but boy, does that sound fascinating to have a position with your firm and just be able to oversee, as we were talking about, seeing all these dynamic and interesting organizations setting up their foundations with you. It's just, I'm sure, so fulfilling and fascinating for anyone that works for you.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I hope we'll continue this dialogue offline.
Absolutely. Again, for those listening, I want to thank Mark Pollock, the president and founder of the Giving Back Fund, for being on this episode of Charity Charge. Again, I also want to spread a heartfelt thank you to all of our listeners. It has been so much fun and joy running the Charity Charge podcast for almost 2 years now. I've been getting a lot of great feedback over the summer, and hope you continue to enjoy these episodes. Take care. Bye for now.